Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Beyond the Baseline is brought to you by T-Mobile this baseball season. T-Mobile customers can get a free season-long subscription to MLB TV Premium. Sign up by April 10th. That's only a few days from now. Sign up at T-Mobile.com/MLB or at MLB.tv while on T-Mobile's network. We're also brought to you by Harry's Razors, which are superior razors. They're shipped straight to your door. I got one just the other day. They are at half drugstore prices, and I think they're probably, at least in Manhattan, much less than half drugstore prices. Get $5 off your first offer with the code BASELINE at harrys.com and by FanDuel. Now that basketball's back, you can try the fun and competition of daily fantasy risk-free up to $10. Go to FanDuel.com and enter the code BEYOND.
I think the perfect sweet spot for any sport as far as health of it, as far as, you know, how much we enjoy it and how much we look back is, you know, Roger and Rafa, both at the top of their games, and their kind of peak crossed over for 5 or 6 years, but they're both legends of the game going at it. You know, you have Everett and Navratilova, McEnroe and Borg, those, you know, Sampras, Agassi, those are the sweet spots. You know, so right now, it's weird to think that Djokovic's legacy, we'd remember it more fondly. People would almost gravitate towards him more if he had someone that was challenging him. If he came and got knocked off a little bit, in a weird way, you know, we would enjoy kind of that process a little bit more when he did win again.
Everyone, John Wertheim here. Thanks for joining us. It's this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast, Beyond the Baseline. This week, we have a guest from Austin, Texas, former world number one Grand Slam champion, bon vivant, father, husband, wit. It's Andy Roddick. A lot of you have been requesting him, and we were able to get him by phone. I think you'll enjoy this conversation. Hard to mess up an interview with Andy. He's a bright guy and always has been. A lot of opinions about a lot of different subjects. This is a bit rambling, but that's by design. We bring him in now. Andy Roddick, hey, thanks for doing this. I appreciate it. We've had a lot of requests to have you on, and I'm glad we got you. Before we get started, you were terrific in this space, and I'm curious, before we even get going, how you prepared, how you went about this. Did you arrive at these podcasts with a list of questions, or did you just fire up and go? Because you had this media mastered.
Oh, I think that's generous. You know, thanks for having me on. You know, we didn't really. I did it with a guy named Bill Ryder, and we didn't really have that many guests on, to be honest. And when we did, it was more of like a conversation where they could kind of hang out the whole time. You know, we actually didn't like having guests on that much because, you know, we would do like random things like top 10 list of 90s TV shows.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, they kind of gave us a creative liberty, which would either turn you off to where you would never want to listen to us again, or you were actually quasi interested in maybe got involved in our kind of stupid, crazy little podcast.
I heard you once do half an hour by yourself. That's impressive.
Yeah, I remember that. It was, I think it was the LA traffic that got Bill, and it was the only time we could do it. And I was actually up in the middle of nowhere in the North Carolina mountains, and they said, should we try it? And I said, I'll wing it. We'll see what happens. I guess, you know, it was, I hadn't really thought about it too much, but I remember, I think you said something, and I think, our friend David Law from England, he was like, I think he was the only guy in the world who actually listened from outside of America, but, he listened and said something about kind of like being able to do it alone, but, I didn't mind doing it that day. It's not something that I was kind of wanting to do, from that day forward either.
All those tennis press conferences served you well. It's a long monologue.
You know what? It's a lot easier sitting back and letting other people do the work and asking the questions and just reacting. That's an easier space for me.
I'm going to sit back and do all the work. I'm going to let you answer the questions.
I appreciate
it. Where are you? Where are we getting you?
I am in Austin, Texas, where we live. I rushed home to be on the podcast today. I was just actually hitting
Thanks,
balls
man.
with Ryan Harrison. He's getting on the clay, which is, you know, clay when I was playing well was a nightmare for me. So imagine 4 years removed, never hitting on it at all. So it was it's a tough ask these days.
All the surfaces are the same. We keep hearing that.
I always
get a kick out of that. All these homogenized surfaces, they may not be as dramatic as they were when, Borg won the French and then Wimbledon, but trust me, there's a difference between Roland Garros and Wimbledon.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a lot more as opposed to like a 0 to 100 scale, let's call it, between French, the French Open and Wimbledon back in the day. I think it's like a 30-70 scale now, or 35-65. I don't know that there's, you never get on a hard court now, and maybe it's changed. I'm obviously talking from a place of ignorance for the last 3 years, but you never really got on like an indoor hard court and said, first guy to the net wins the point, or it didn't really work like that anymore.
All right, let's get to tennis in a second, but more importantly, fatherhood's treating you well. You're sleeping a little
yeah.
bit.
Yeah, man, it's amazing because I'm not super dramatic. I don't really buy into cliches that much. I'm not the guy that's going to cry at a Hallmark commercial. but all the cliches about being a parent are true. He comes out and 10 seconds after he existed, it's like you care about it more than you've ever cared about anything in your life. So it's a crazy deal, but that, and you kind of have a lot of respect for what a woman goes through, with having a kid and in waking up during the night and it's a huge ask, but man, it's rewarding and it's a lot of fun.
I got bad news for you. I got good news and bad news. The bad news is that these cliches, they continue being true. Much as we all hate trafficking and cliches, all these things, like, it goes so fast, you won't believe these people, they grow up. Every awful parenting cliche actually has some basis behind it. Is your
I've become the guy. I'll be like golfing with some guys, some buddies from the place I play golf, and we'll be on like the third tee. I'm like, well, check out what Hank did. He ate for the first time today, and I'm like showing. They're like, dude, what are you doing? Guy time. Like, stop it.
We all do that.
Yeah.
Sleep's okay. I'm thinking being a tennis player probably good preparation for that. You don't know when you're going on the court. You got jet lag. It's probably actually pretty good preparation for this drill.
Yeah, you think so. I don't know that being tired translates to being tired. I think tired is tired at any rate. But Brooke's pretty cool. I mean, she did a lot of the heavy lifting at night. Her theory was that we don't need two exhausted people during the day. So then, I got up early if he woke up early, and I'd kind of take him, and then I'd spell her in the afternoon if she wanted to take a nap. So she thought that I could add more value at those times than actually getting up with her at night. So I was completely with that program.
I feel like you, maybe literally, but I'm talking figuratively, you kind of bought low, sold high. You were in on Austin before Austin got hip. I congratulate you on that, but it's weird to see this. I remember tell the story real quick. Didn't you play tennis with, was it Drew Brees or Chris Mim or something? When you were a kid, I can't remember the story.
Yeah,
you played tennis with Drew Brees?
Both of them, actually. Mim was, he grew too big for tennis, and his knees went bad and whatever, but Drew used to play like the local tournaments here. And I couldn't beat him. He was kind of like the best in the city. I mean, he was 3 or 4 years older than I was. Still is probably. But he would beat me. I forget if it was once, twice, or whenever it was. But then I finally beat him, and he decided to quit tennis. So I always joke that football fans can thank me, or Saints fans more particular.
Worked out all right for him. But no, is it weird seeing your city being transformed into this sort of hipsterville? My hipster's neighbor. We're moving. We're putting our place on the market. Where are you going? Austin. Where else? I'd heard Ethan Hawkins heard on a podcast. Austin is that's a hip town you got. Weird to see this transformation.
You know, it used to be a best kept secret, and now it's like the worst kept secret. You know, it's crazy because the skyline we used to have this building called the Frost Tower, and that was kind of the only thing that was big. And even back in the day, I think I heard that there was a law, nothing was allowed to be taller than the Capitol building.
Yeah, right. Right.
And that's completely changed. I mean, it's like you can barely see the Capitol building from a lot of angles now when you're looking at downtown. And, you know, it's been a lot of years of skyscrapers, and you see South by Southwest come in. And, you know, I always used to make fun of like people going to Coachella. You have to wear like the Coachella uniform.
Yeah, right.
And now I feel like it's a South by Southwest uniform, you know, and it's kind of like, you know, we don't all wear cowboy boots and cowboy hats every day, but, you know, more power to you.
Your handlebar mustache is intact, I hope. You know what's the next Austin, too, is you're going to get double whammy. Asheville, North Carolina is fast being Austinized.
Yeah, well, we're far enough away from Asheville where we're I don't think we're directly in the firing line. But I mean, they're both great places. I think Asheville will probably get hit less than Austin just based on state income tax. And I think it's a viable, you know, Texas is such a viable place for business, and
right. The
economy has been so strong. I don't know that that's by accident. So, you know, you do see a lot of businesses relocating from places like, especially California. So they've made it a nice place for big business to come. They've made it a nice place for, it's always been a great place for musicians, but acting, tech, you know, all those big tech companies have satellite offices here. So it's really been kind of a crafted overnight success that's taken place over the course of 15 or 20 years, you know?
Just watch out for what happens when the price of oil starts falling.
Hopefully it's bottomed out. I mean, I'm not sure it's going to get much lower than $28 a barrel, or whatever it was about 6 weeks ago. So at least I hope not, because my bet's on it being above that.
for people my age and your brother's age, it's like high school when you fill up your car now. You're like $13 to fill up a car. I haven't done that.
I know it'll regulate. I mean, you know, everything kind of goes up and down. I remember, you know, however long ago it was like people couldn't afford gas, and now it's down. And it's funny how the rhetoric around these problems is always like it's going to be permanent. You know, I don't know. It'll go up. I think people, you know, it's not so much of an Austin thing with the oil as it is like a Dallas Houston issue as far as people that have made their money through that business.
Watch my segue here. Watch how we do this. I would say tennis is kind of cyclical too in that sense. The sports cooked after after Nadal, Federer, and Djokovic leave. This sport is cooked. What are you seeing out there now? You just said you came from the courts with Ryan Harris. What's your intersection of your life in tennis these days?
Yeah, you know it's a good segue when you have to explain it.
We're gonna edit that out.
You know what? I'm pumped about as a tennis fan. I'm pumped to see these American kids coming up. And I think the best thing that they have going for them is that there's a lineup of them. It's not one guy or two guys, you know, to where if they have a bad couple of tournaments, it's like this, you know, constant story. Hopefully the story will be about someone else playing well that week. And I think that's what kind of the golden generation of American tennis benefited from. You know, Andre was allowed to kind of fall off the face of the planet, and we still had people to fill that gap. And then he was able to come back, you know, kind of work his way through a challenger, and you know, that's extreme. But those guys were allowed to have an off week or two, or even an off year. And you know, Pete and Courier and Chang, and there was always someone relevant in there. I don't know that was always the case through my career. You know, but these young guys are playing great, and that's probably the most exciting thing for me to see.
when you won the U.S. Open, the first thing you said when you walked off the court is, I don't have to answer any more questions about when's the next American to win a major. Now these guys get it all the time. Does that, I mean, it's annoying. I can only imagine what it's like to go from town to town and hear this every week as if it's a fresh perspective. But does that have any material bearing? I mean, do you think these kids are really materially feeling pressure that it's been whatever it's been 13 years, or is it just one of these annoyances?
I really don't. I mean, the question around me was kind of stupid just because, you know, Pete won the last guy to win a U.S. Open before me was American. So I just didn't understand that.
Right.
I actually didn't understand the rhetoric. They just wanted to be someone else. You know, it's like the thing I think I see in sports the most is, you know, and you even segued with this question is, you know, what's next after these guys? And I'm saying, man, let's settle in and enjoy the end of this kind of greatest generation. You know, I think we're in too much of a hurry to kind of get to the next thing. But as it pertains to the question of these guys feeling the pressure, not yet. You know, I think it's hard to, I don't think it's a realistic conversation to ask Francis Tiafoe or Fritz or Tommy Paul or whatever about winning a major, because they haven't even experienced anything close to that yet. You know, I think they have to, and not to say that they've made great progress and it's been fun to see them, and they're certainly pushing guys that are at the top level, but there's a difference between that and actually being at the top level yourself. You know, so I don't think that's a realistic conversation yet, but I definitely think it can be in the future.
All right, Andy Roddick, hold that thought. You are a baseball fan. You once threw out the first pitch at an Oakland A's game, if memory serves. And now you, Andy Roddick, and you, listeners, can catch every Major League Baseball game. It's only on T-Mobile for customers that get a free year-long MLB TV premium subscription, a $109.99 value for free, so you'll never miss a game. Hurry up and sign up by April 10th to catch any out-of-market game all season long. That's over 2,400 Major League games, over 7,000 hours of baseball that'll never touch your data plan. Thanks to Binge On from T-Mobile, you can stream your favorite team's games without using any of your data. T-Mobile has you covered, unlike all those other guys. I have always wanted to do infomercial voice. Here we go. You ready? Sign up for MLB.TV while on T-Mobile's network. New MLB.TV premium subscriptions only. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.TV for details. Binge On available to T-Mobile customers with qualifying plans. Detectable video typically streams a DVD quality video from participating services. Don't count against full speed data on U.S. network. Third-party subscription charges may apply. Offer void where prohibited. Actually doesn't say that. I just added that. Check out MLB.TV now. Did you watch the, we're doing this on a Wednesday. Did you happen to catch UConn women's hoops last night?
I didn't. I was reading about it. You'd be shocked how little sports I actually watch now.
With the little guy, or is that mid-30s?
The little guy, and the fact that it's not quite my job, and it coincided with we're still battling our way through the new season of House of Cards. So
that's a good one.
It's this crazy mix of all that stuff, which and I guess the shorter answer for this would have been no, I didn't see it.
So I was going to go on a tangent and say, how much would binge watching have helped the career of a tennis player 10 years ago, where you could just wait for your court time by knocking off, you know, billions or House of Cards, whatever. No, UConn, I mean, I think the halftime score was something like 50-21. And it did rekindle this debate, and we see it in tennis. You know, do we want parity, or do we want these clear-cut champions? You know, for all intents, Novak's undefeated this year. Good for tennis, bad for tennis. Can we appreciate him? Do you wish someone rose to the challenge? Can we just sit back and say, we thought it was Pete, then we thought it was Roger, then maybe it was Rafa, and now here is another player that's making a bid for greatest of all time? I mean, how much are you concerned, or how much you enjoy the fact that we have a guy that's just playing at a completely different level, it seems, than the rest of the field right now?
See, the good news is I don't have to choose one side of that. Do I want Roger to come up and challenge him, or do we want one of the young guys to challenge him? Yes. Do I appreciate what's going on? Absolutely. you know, I don't have to choose. I think the perfect sweet spot for any sport as far as health of it, as far as, you know, how much we enjoy it and how much we look back is, you know, Roger and Rafa, both at the top of their games, and their kind of peak crossed over for 5 or 6 years, but they're both legends of the game going at it. You know, you have Everett and Navratilova, McEnroe and Borg, those, you know, Sampras, Agassi, those are the sweet spots. You know, so right now, it's weird to think that Djokovic's legacy would be better if someone came up, or we would, not even better, that's the wrong terminology, we'd remember it more fondly. People would almost gravitate towards him more if he had someone that was challenging him. If he came and got knocked off a little bit, in a weird way, you know, we would enjoy kind of that process a little bit more when he did win again. But what he's doing is just amazing. So as a former player, looking at it, not just wanting to be entertained, I can certainly appreciate what he's doing. I mean, it's real impressive. I mean, the guy doesn't have any holes in his game. I feel like even when he's not playing well, he's still winning in straight sets. I mean, it's, you know, I watched him at Indian Wells for a couple of matches and he didn't look great. And he, by the end of the tournament, he was still rolling people. So, right. You know, we were ready to throw a party because Rafa got him to a breaker in the semifinals there. You know, it's insane kind of the precedent that he's been able to set.
All right, we'll get back to Andy in a second. Actually, Andy played with Scruff for parts of his career. When I was a full-time writer and didn't have to go to the office and show my face, I wrote with Scruff. I don't do that anymore. You know what I use now? Harry's razors. You know why razors are locked in that plexiglass case at drugstores? It's because they cost so much, they're afraid that they'll get shoplifted. Well, you know what? Harry's razors are a fraction of the cost of that Rite Aid and CVS razor behind the glass case. Two guys started Harry's.com, and they sell high-quality blades that provide a close, comfortable shave for half the price. And I'm telling you, it is less than half the price, at least if you're living in Manhattan, than your conventional razors. Again, these are the best razors I have ever used. I say that with full candor. I was sent one maybe 2 weeks ago, and I am an absolute Converse. I have yet to change the blade. I shave every day. This is the best shave I have ever gotten. I feel almost, Jamie, we would almost be inclined to take a selfie and put it on the site to show this clean shave. Just, you seen a cleaner shave? I don't think you have. Harry's starter set is the best option for new customers. It's a great deal. For $15, you get a razor handle, shaving gel, and three of the five-blade German-engineered razors. Plus, for listeners of this show, Harry's giving you $5 off your first purchase with the promo code BASELINE. Go to harrys.com right now. That's harrys.com. Make sure you use the code BASELINE. I'm telling you, these are the best razors you will use. What about and sort of jump in wherever here? Where do you stand on some of the less savory? It's been an interesting 90 days, 100 days for our sport so far in 2016. Are you sort of watching this from afar? Are you particularly agitated by one issue or another? I mean, what's your take on some of these? Whether it's match fixing or Maria or just sort of the general craziness of the first 100 days here.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. I like Maria. I think she's always gone about it the right way. Do I think that she honestly knew anything? I think it was an honest mistake what she did. Now, the conversation on, you know, what she was taking and whether that was, you know, kind of abuse of something that was legal, and that's a whole other conversation. The part of the conversation that interests me that hasn't been brought up one time, and if it was any other sport, it would be talked about ad nauseum, is what this does to her Hall of Fame candidacy.
Right.
You know, any other sport, you know, baseball, it's like, it's a pretty clear line in the sand that it would be no. Football, you know, people have done some terrible, terrible things off the field and still gotten in. You know, so there's different conversations, but that's kind of the interesting conversation to me that I haven't even heard once yet.
Well, to me, Hall of Fame is sort of a pretext for how in these other sports, for how much should we discount what was achieved, right? I mean, I think people look at Bonds' home run record is tainted, or, you know, Sammy Sosa's home run chase is tainted. To me, what hasn't been discussed is how much should we be looking back at these majors and reconsidering their legitimacy if this
hearing doesn't go the way she wants. No, you can't. I mean, if something's legal and she's winning them while it's legal, there's no conversation. Mm. You know, now you can disagree with me, but maybe that's where the discussion is. It's always more interesting of a discussion when everyone's not just agreeing with each other and nodding, you know, with a right. microphone next to the next person.
My issue with that is there are a lot of things. I mean, whether it's historical, I mean, it doesn't have to be just in sports. I mean, there are a lot of things that we know in our gut are wrong that may not be codified as wrong.
Well,
and
we still have to make a decision
to do it or not, right?
So let's take, you know, you obviously don't like it and you're questioning the legitimacy of slams. Well, okay, but you can't argue with me and then say you're not doing that. But so let's take the legitimacy of slams based on what she's taken and you want to put a question mark next to it. That's fine. But then how far do you take it? Do you take it to what McEnroe's admitted to doing, like in 84, and start questioning his whole thing? That'll never happen. So you have to kind of be fair on all sides of it.
Yeah, I'm kind of reserving judgment until there's a hearing and we know a little bit more. And did she put these drugs on her forms? My only point is when people say, hey, look, it wasn't on the list before 2016, therefore she wasn't doing anything wrong. Well, I don't know about that. I mean, if I have a company policy and they don't codify you can't plagiarize, I may not have technically violated it till that appears on company policy, but I still know in my gut that I'm doing something unethical.
But John, that's ridiculous. That's like saying in everyday life something becomes a law. That's like saying drinking. Let's say drinking had been outlawed for a certain amount of time, and then all of a sudden it's legal, and then you're going to go back and penalize someone the other way around. Let's say it was legal, and let's say they banned drinking next year, and now all of a sudden, yeah, I mean, that's a very slippery slope.
Sure.
I mean, my thing is, she won things. She won it legally. Nothing was banned. And, you know, she did win five slams without it. So I'm not going to sit here and take that away from her. Now, do we want to judge she will get judged on the entire context of her career on getting popped for something. And I think that's fair also.
I don't think we're that far apart. My only point is that I just think it's too easy to say it wasn't on the list until January 1st of this year. Ergo, she wasn't doing anything wrong before then. Like, we do this all the time where we make judgments and we have ethics, even if there isn't something.
Okay, well, we're having two different conversations, because whether or not you think she was wrong for it, I certainly respect your opinion either way, but whether it, you know, takes away from her five slams, absolutely not. There's no chance.
Right.
I mean, if you're talking about a moral issue, and if you judge her morally, that's one thing, but she still won five slams. She won the career Grand Slam while taking something that was not illegal. Now, did she... You know, there's a lot of gray area, but she won those slams not taking anything that was a banned substance.
Right. I mean, I wrote about this today, too, that I find this whole conversation just gone in so many strange directions with players, too, where, you know, we have players weighing in on whether she's arrogant or not. And I'm thinking you support your colleague, or you're very angry at your colleague because she took money off your table, in a sense. You have thoughts about performance-enhancing drugs. Whether Maria Sharapova said hi to you in the locker room is really kind of irrelevant as a discussion point right now. But
I agree. I think you have to base it on facts, not what, you know. I think some people out there, just based on success, success breeds jealousy. I think that's a natural human emotion. Am I going to judge her harsher because she wasn't the friendliest in the locker room? I don't really care about that. That makes no difference to me as far as the context of her career. If she was the greatest in the locker room, then great. We'll give her credit for that. But I just couldn't care less whether or not she said hi to, you know, someone she didn't know or someone she didn't before. Whatever. That makes no difference to me.
No, I'd like to see the discussion should be restricted to how do we
agreed.
Feel about it. Anyway.
Agreed.
So I was talking to a former NBA player, a couple weeks ago, and he was saying it was really hard for him to watch basketball after he retired, because he'd turn on a game and he could say, man, I could still play with, I can't curse on the show, but I could still play with those guys.
Yeah.
What was your relationship like? I mean, you're a guy who were still an awfully credible player when you decided to retire.
Mm-hmm.
Strange to turn on the TV a year later and say, you know what, I'm winning that match if I'm on the court right now.
The thing was, I didn't have to think that because I kind of knew it. I mean, the last term I played, I made the second week of a slam.
Yeah, right.
And I won, you know, I won two out of my last five events, I think. I think that's the right amount. It was two out of five or two out of six. You know, so I didn't really wonder if I could still play. My shoulder was pretty bad for a year afterwards. So that was, you know, it wasn't really a realistic conversation. You know, and then kind of time goes on and you're two or three years and all of a sudden my shoulder feels better and I can hit, you know, the numbers that I used to hit. And then I start, and then the conversation starts to roll. It's like, well, geez, you know, the what if game is always fun. And I think it's inevitable if you're a former athlete and, you know, I love hitting with the current guys still just because my ego needs it. You know, you need to know that barometer and you kind of need to know where you think you'd be. But I think it's impossible to do something your entire life and then you're kind of judged against a certain result or where you are. And that's kind of, you know, for better or for worse, that a lot of your self-worth comes from that in a given moment. And so I think that's only natural to kind of wonder.
This is going to be the ball washing portion of today's show. But I put you in that category with Curry or with someone like Lindsay as someone who's sort of intelligence and curiosity outstrip their formal education.
Yeah.
All modesty aside, does being a bright guy with interest, did that help your transition after you were done playing or was that a complicating factor?
Well, I have a theory about that and I think it helps. You know, you mentioned Jim and I think he's, you know, a very, very, very smart human and same with Lindsay. But I think the difference with that, and it's kind of a different way to go about the conversation is a lot of people who are on tour, their social life and their social existence and their friend structure and exists on tour. I had friends on tour. I love joking with guys in the locker room, but kind of the meat and potatoes of my close friendships didn't exist on tour. You know, so I didn't feel like when I was retiring from, you know, a 15-year social circle as well as kind of my job. And I think that part probably makes it a little easier.
That's an interesting, was that by accident or by design? Was that just sort of your...
No, it wasn't. I don't know that I was that calculated. You know, I have, you know, my friend James and Marty, I'll always talk to all the time, but I still talk to them all the time. So it's not a whole lot different. You know, it's kind of... You make and it's no different for you covering tennis. You have a million acquaintances, but probably a handful of like lifelong, really close friends from that world. You know, and I didn't have to sacrifice those lifelong friends just because I was retiring.
Right, right. Are you said you just walked off the court with Harrison? Is that sort of a, you know, it's lineage? Is this you're doing this to stay in shape. You're taking an interest in this kid. I mean, that interests me. I mean, you've got a kid. You're a husband. You're hitting ball. Yeah. You're hitting balls on a Wednesday. Why?
Yeah. Well, the difference is when I first retired, I could play 18, hit, and do it all. And now I kind of have to choose something. I always joke that I'm allowed to do like one thing a day now with a kid. But the reasoning why, I don't know. I like Ryan. You know, I still enjoy hitting, so it's not like a completely selfless endeavor. I like going out there. I like, you know, sweating a little bit and, you know, it's an excuse to get out there. And, you know, I don't go to many tennis tournaments, you know, unless I'm working or making a corporate appearance or something. I don't really just go to watch much. And so it's still nice to kind of connect into that world that you existed in for so long. And I enjoy talking tennis. I enjoy playing. I never got to the point where I was even during or after where I was bitter about the game and all. I hear a lot of people have that. I didn't. I've always just enjoyed it and kind of I've completely gotten the fact that pretty much anything good that I have in my life came in some way or another from tennis. So, you know, if Ryan says, you know, hey, I'm going to be home for 2 weeks, can I steal some days from you to get out and hit some balls? And yeah, I'd love to. That'd be great.
You said before that you don't follow sports all that much, which sounds like common sentiment for most people of our age, but you are a huge, I mean, your sports knowledge is prodigious.
Yeah, I don't want to say that I don't watch sports much. I'd say at this point I'm probably less informed than I normally am, which is normally very, very informed. You know, but I just with the baby and everything else, there's you know, as anyone with kids would know, there's a lot less kind of dead time where you just flip it on to, you know, whatever channel and catch up. You know, so I'm a massive sports fan, and I watch what I can. But just the last 6 months has been a little hit or miss.
But you'll come back to the tribe. You'll
I certainly haven't written it off. You know, it's part of the fabric of
me,
and I've been a sports fan for so long, but it's just I'm a little scratchy right now. As far I'm not sure I could go, you know, live TV and kind of walk through everything right now.
You were one of these guys I think a lot of people pegged very early as this guy is going to have a job in media when he's done. This guy's going to be a commentator. And you had a job shortly after you were done playing at Fox Sports 1 that, ironically enough, had very little tennis. I mean, this was kind of a general... Your sports knowledge was, I think, really what you drew on and not... it wasn't very tennis-related at all. Then you were at BBC for Wimbledon and fit in seamlessly. Where's sports media in your sort of ether right now?
I don't think it's a priority. I enjoy it. I like to know that I can do it well. I enjoy the process when I am doing it, but I don't know that if I'm away from home for X amount of time a year, and, you know, it's tough for me to carve out, you know, the 3 or 4 months right now that it would take to actually be really, really good at it and kind of, you know, there's not a lot of companies that want to hire you on your terms for, you know, X amount here and a couple of days here and there. And I think the thing that I like most about my life is that I kind of control my schedule. So to give that up is something that I don't do easily now. So that's kind of a damper on the sports media side. But I enjoy doing it, and I feel comfortable doing it.
You'll be back at Wimbledon?
I'm not going back this year. I loved it. I had a blast doing it. You know, obviously doing BBC is so prestigious, and you know, to do my third match ever and have it be you know, my first ever match that I called or third match that I ever called live be the Wimbledon final was a pretty fast transition, but I enjoyed it. I liked it. Being in the studio for me was pretty easy because of the work at Fox Sports 1, except now I was talking about something that I actually might have known something about.
You didn't have to get there 4 hours early for production meeting either.
Yeah, and I walked through the draw early, and I think that I had played all the guys except for like 20 in the draw. You know, so that obviously helped a lot. I loved it. I certainly haven't closed the book on it, but you know, I'm not sure that I want to be away in the summer, you know, away from him that much.
You don't want to make that, you don't want to cross oceans, you know, with a 9-month.
Yeah, it's just time. You know, it's just, I'm very selfish with my time with, I just love being around the little guy so much that it's just hard to pull me away.
While tennis is rounding into mid-season form, we're on to the clay. You know what's back? Baseball's back. The Mets are losing to the Royals again. Clayton Kershaw is pitching. We've got drama. We have plenty of hot takes on Batista and tossing the bats. Yes, baseball's back. Freshly mowed grass and all that. You're dying to play fantasy baseball. You know you are. And if you're not playing FanDuel this season, you're missing out on the most baseball fun a fan can have. On FanDuel, you choose. Do I compete to win cash from fans around the world? Or do I want to start a listener league with my friends? Either way, you get to be the GM. You get to be the Theo Epstein. You study the matches. You get your money ball on. You set your lineup. Entry fees are back at $1. There's no commitment. Play for one day. Play for 180 days plus the playoffs. And here's the best part. FanDuel is giving new players their first game risk-free. Here's what you do. Go to FanDuel.com. Enter the code BEYOND. Then enter a FanDuel league. Start one with your friends. If you don't win any prize money in the first contest, you know what? You get your $10 right back. That's what I call no risk. FanDuel.com comes with my code BEYOND. Risk-free, up to $10. Play now. When you were at Wimbledon, you did live matches, but I remember sitting in the BBC studio when Serena Williams came in, and I suspect people could pull this off YouTube, but it was a great sort of authentic segment. You guys have known each other forever. I'm sure you're asked this in social situations and casually, and people say, oh, what's Serena Williams like? I thought you had a really unique take on her. How far back do you go and kind of when people say, what's Serena Williams like, what do you tell them?
Yeah, I do get asked that a lot. And I have a, you know, I know a very, very different side of Serena than she shows often. I've known her since we were 8 or 9 years old, maybe. Right. And, you know, at Rick Macy's in South Florida, for 3 or 4 years of our lives when we were young, it was me on one court, Serena on one court, and Venus on one court. And that's just what we did, you know, and we all just trained every day. And, you know, I don't think people know how hard those girls trained when they were very, very young. I mean, we're talking all day, every day, hitting balls, very intense. I mean, they didn't become what they became by accident at all. But Serena was here. She came to see the baby. I don't know when it was one or, you know, he's probably 6 weeks old or something. And we were talking and, you know, it's just, she's so sweet and so nice and holding our son and, you know, laughing and joking and laid back and, you know, talking about a million different topics. And I go, gosh, Serena, you just don't, people just don't know, you know? And I said, I watch after the US Open and it's like, it's hard to watch you talk about it. And I honestly just think that she cares so much about winning and losing that she's not capable of getting over how pissed off she is when she goes in. And I wrote a piece for actually we worked on it together, but Sports Person of the Year. And I said, listen, you know, if Jordan was pissed off after a loss, the rhetoric was he's so competitive, he's so pissed, that's why he's so great. And for whatever reason, when it's around Serena and she's pissed off, it's aloof and she doesn't come off the right way. And I'm not sure if it's just the individual nature of tennis or you know, kind of what the undertones might be there, but
I think there might be a gender issue in there, but sorry, keep going.
Yeah, I mean, that's for other people to say. You know, you have to ask enough questions and you cross enough stuff off and that kind of stays on the list most times. But you know, I wish people saw and knew her the way that I do. I mean, she just couldn't be sweeter. And I'm not sure that's the way that she's described in the tennis or the sports world often.
It's funny. I was talking to James about her in Indian Wells, and he said, I have never seen another athlete compete the way she has. I mean, she's male, female, individual sport, team sport. I have never seen a competitor like her. And your first instinct is to sort of play this game that people like us play and devil's advocate. Oh, what about? I was stumped. I mean, I'm not sure that in our lifetime there is an athlete that has had her competitive instincts. And
yeah, the thing is that she's just if she was a guy and she wore her emotions on her sleeve all the time, good, bad, got pissed, and like people look back on. I mean, I threw fits a million times, right? And in the moment, they weren't always great. And in the moment I might've gotten criticized and in the moment, you know, people said I was a brat and they're probably right. But like now people look back and they laugh about it, you know, and it's like, okay, that was kind of funny. And you know, that's normally what it is. And she doesn't get the benefit of that doubt. So whatever that conversation is, I just feel, you know, she'll, you know, I told her, I was like, you're your own worst enemy sometimes. You know, you go in and you just give people nothing, you know, but that's just the way she ticks. And you know, there are different routes to greatness, and you know, it's easy. You know, if people had a camera on everyone's worst day at work, they would look worse than Serena does on her worst day at work. You know, as far as their attitude, as far as the way they talk about things, they would look worse than she does.
No, but I think the other point you raised is a good. I mean, what do we say about Russell Westbrook? He's a prick, but he's an animal. He's a serial killer, and he's a ninja.
Yeah, I mean,
it doesn't seem like she gets the benefit of
having an edge and kind of being mean and pissed off and, you know, all the things that she can be when things are going her way are presented a different way a lot of the time in sports.
Last few questions. What else is impressing you in sports right now? I mean, when you, is it the Warriors have your attention? I mean, you you did this in your previous job, but I feel like even as a player, you always had interesting insights about the sports landscape overall.
You know what's pissing me off a little bit is
what's that?
You mentioned the Warriors, and I think it's unbelievable, and I think tennis players do a good job of, you know, you ask Andre Agassi. I think you had him on the pod. Did you have him on the podcast recently?
Yeah. Yes, we did.
Yeah. So if you ask him about the way that the guys are playing now, he goes, he's effusive in his praise. He'll say Roger was unbelievable. The way Novak's playing, it's very comparable to me, except he's 6'3". He moves better. He's more flexible. You know, he covers more ground. He'll tell you that Novak's playing a different brand of tennis and a better brand of tennis than he played. Now, when people talk about the Warriors, whether it's Scottie Pippen saying they're going to sweep them, or Oscar Robertson criticizing Steph Curry, or, you know, I worked with Gary Payton at Fox Sports 1, and anybody who was current was automatically worse than anybody who played in the 90s. And yeah, I just don't Gary understand Payton. What these guys, like, there's like an insecurity around like 1990s NBA basketball guys, where they just can't give credit to something that's not only new, but different. Like, the Warriors are playing a different brand of basketball. They're like, well, the Knicks in the 90s played, you know, they beat you up. I'm like, the Knicks in the 90s also lost a lot more. They weren't as good of a team. They're not even close to as good of a team. And it's like, there's this little thing where all you read is these former guys kind of clinging to past glory. And it's just, it's a little, Scottie Pippen doesn't need to defend how good they were. Like, just right. Be comfortable in right. It.
My theory too about the Warriors, it's a little like we were talking before about, I mean, it's almost like Roger. You know how Roger does not get described as an assassin. And these Warriors, I mean, they're not badasses. Steph Curry, you look at him. I mean, if you look at LeBron James and he's getting from half court to the basket in one dribble, and physically he looks like a different era. If you're Oscar Robertson, you say, yeah, you know, I don't know if I could stop that guy. They look at Steph Curry and he's, you know, 6'3", and looks like the kind of guy they played in high school with. And they can't get over the fact that he might be better than they are.
Well, shit. I mean, you can't say that, but you can bleep that out, hopefully. But the thing is, they're like, I could guard him. I'm like, you'd have to guard him out to 28 feet.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Pippen's like, I'd guard him. I would be on him. It's like, all right, well, then he's stretching you out to 28 feet. All of a sudden, the best defender on the Bulls team is a non-starter once Steph passes the ball off. You know, he's literally taken out of an entire defensive system if he has to play that far out. I go, there needs to be a little bit, there needs to be some more layers to the discussion than just, oh, Pippen would shut Steph Curry down. It's not one-on-one basketball. You know, that's not the way it works.
But what do you think about it? First, I mean, some of this is just like, the older I get, the faster I was. But I wonder if the fact that the Warriors have no badass in them, right? I mean, it's like whistle while you work and everybody's having a good time and they make funny videos. You know, those Jordan Bulls were intense teams. I wonder if the fact that these seem like nice guys doesn't also sort of change perception among these players from the 90s. Right?
Well, I mean, I think that probably has something to do with it. I think just because it's different, that means they, you know, the guys might not understand it the same way. Therefore, they don't view it the same way. You know, it's like you don't have to snarl at somebody when all you're doing is draining jumpers and your ball movement is like the best we've ever seen. You know, and your center is what Draymond Green's like 6'6" in his dreams. And he can play center. He can play small forward. You know, it's just different. I think it's not easy to kind of put an easy term on. You kind of have to think about it. Why is it working? And, you know, I just don't think that I'm just mad at normally greatness, like recognizes greatness. And I don't think that's happening. And it's kind of annoying. And I kind of roll my eyes every time one of these former greats comes out of, you know, who knows where and is critical of them just because it's different from the way they did it.
I'm telling you, I've never seen a team play like this, but there are empirical measurements too, right? I mean, you can look at their spacing and their efficiency and their shooting. I mean, you can make a statistical case too that this team's as good as we all think they are.
Yeah, I mean, I remember last year I was on Fox Sports 1 and we're talking about them, and this was like midway through the season, and they, you know, they weren't the team that won. They weren't this year's team in the regular season. They hadn't kind of established themselves. I'm not sure that they hadn't been to an NBA Finals yet. And they go, who's your pick to win it all? And they're in first place. They're I think number one in offensive efficiency and number two in defensive efficiency on the season. I go, the Warriors. The Warriors are they're my favorite. And they go, well, what are you talking about? I go, which way do you want it? Do you want it based on, you know, clutch players, ability to stretch the floor, offense, defense? I go, I'm not understanding why this is a surprise to everybody. And for some reason, just because they play something that's a little bit different, you know, I guess they're going to need some more time to prove themselves.
I like that. Usually my big gripe with tennis is that it's still stuck in 1981. And that, you know, I always used to say if the NBA finals were going on and you had guys from the 80s saying back in my day and talking about games from 1986, everybody would say the sport's stuck in the past. Now basketball's going that way as well.
Yeah, it's a little nuts. I get a little agitated listening to it sometimes on TV when, you know, Rafa is like flipping a short forehand that's landing on the service line, but it's landing on the service line and then jumping over someone's shoulder and tailing away, you know, that lefty to a righty backhand, and like, look at where that's bouncing. You got to come in on that. I'm like, okay, it's bouncing the service line. It's up above your shoulder and it's crossing the sideline before the baseline. I'm not sure how you can actually think that you can come in off that. Like, that's an antiquated
view.
It's just not.
They're not taking chances.
It's nonsensical. It's like, take it on the rise. I'm like, on the rise doesn't exist anymore. It's just a matter of court positioning. It's not like you're taking it on the rise with a chip and trying to establish position at the net. That's not something that's a realistic play anymore with the strings and the way guys are playing. That's just not a realistic view.
My favorite one of those, and she, I don't want to pick on her because she's actually very good about grounding herself in the present. But when Tracy Austin won the U.S. Open, she weighed 88 pounds. I'm thinking the game's evolved a little since then. I'm thinking your metrics from back then. All right, this is great. I've taken a lot of your time. This was I'm glad we did this. We got to do this again.
No.
We talked Maria.
I appreciate it.
Covered a lot of ground. Go go spend time with your son. It's more important than sports.
I'm going to. All right. Thanks, John.
Take it easy. Thanks. All right, that was Andy Roddick. That was a fun visit. It always is. Pity he won't be at Wimbledon. His broadcast on BBC was must-see TV. I think he has a long career in TV if he wants to go that way, but obviously a lot of options. Always have enjoyed talking to Andy. We've been doing this for many, many years together. I didn't even tell the story of the first time I interviewed him. I was in my 20s, and he was in his teens, and we went to his house in Florida where we drank Hawaiian Punch and talked about his ascending tennis career. So we've known each other a while. Always a pleasure talking. A few of you had suggested him, and that was a good suggestion. Open to more. We have a special guest, a surprise guest we're trying to line up for next week. I won't give much more away, but you'll want to listen. Thanks again to our fearless producer, Jamie Lasanti, who does great work here. If you enjoy SI.com's tennis coverage in general, know that she is the brains and brawn behind it. You can follow me at John_Wertheim on Twitter. Subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcast app of choice. Hear the whole SI network at si.com/podcasts. Have a good week, everyone. We'll be back in 7 days. Thanks for listening.